You know, over and over, I go through the challenge every weekend of saying, what am I going to do this show on? And then I pick up one of the science journals that I read and find a new discovery, a new happening, a new understanding, and shazam, a show is formed. And it happened this week when I read the new online research that was just released in June on phthalates. And you go, Eve, excuse me, I don't recognize that as a fruit or a vegetable or as something to eat. And that's because phthalate is a chemical. And it is a chemical that is used and creates a toxic burden for us. Phthalates are called plasticizers. And they're a group of industrial chemicals that are used to make plastics like PVC, polyvinyl chloride. And what it does is it makes it more flexible or more resilient. And phthalates are also used as solvents. They're everywhere in our society. We can find them in toys, in food packaging. We can find them in garden hoses and raincoats and shower curtains and even vinyl flooring. Lubricants, adhesives, detergents, nail polishes, hairspray and shampoo. And boy, I'm going to be coming after that hairspray and shampoo today. Phthalates have been found to disrupt your endocrine system. And several phthalate compounds have caused reduced sperm counts, testicular atrophy, two words you do not ever want to use together in the same sentence, and structural abnormalities in the reproductive systems of male animals. It's also been connected to liver cancer. And was listed in the United States Center for Disease Control's National Report on Human Exposure to Environmental Chemicals. The CDC contends that the health hazards of phthalates have not been definitively established, but the new study that was released in June absolutely, positively, and beyond a shadow of a doubt finds that phthalates are not only a risk for obesity, they're a risk for diabetes. A risk for obesity. Now, we always thought that obesity simply came because we ate too much. But you know, Dr. Luke Chelton, and I tip my hat to him often on this show, the late Dr. Chelton was my mentor for 28 years until his passing after a hike in the Georgia woods where he fell down a slope and broke his hip. And developed a blood clot from it and never came out of the hospital. Dr. Chelton was my mentor for so many years. And he told me at one point that people don't get fat just because they eat too much. People get fat in order to have a storage depot to put their toxins. And I can remember how silly that sounded at the time. And guess what? Dr. Chelton, you were right again. It is the toxins. The Environmental Working Group has focused on phthalates for the last dozen years. And the Environmental Working Group reported the fact that they had found phthalates in dozens and dozens and dozens of bottles of nail polish, and it was present in the bodies of every single solitary American that they tested. You know, a decade ago when EWG did an analysis of the Center for Disease Control data, it was a study called Beauty Secrets, they found these industrial pollutants of phthalate in every single solitary American that was tested. And then in 2003, EWG published what I think to be one of the most important studies that was ever done on toxins. It was called the Body Burden Study. And they found as many as 210 industrial and chemical pollutants in bodies, about a half a dozen of which were phthalates. That's an astounding number of toxins. And so in 2008, as a result of pressure from the Environmental Working Group and other health groups, the United States Congress, remember those boys and women, passed legislation banning six phthalates from children's toys and from cosmetics. Certain states, Washington, Vermont, California, have also restricted phthalate use in children's goods, and a whole lot of retailers from Walmart to Toys R Us to, you know, even flow, the bottle makers have said they are phasing out phthalate-laden toys. Well, what are they doing in all of these things? You know, they're so widespread in their use that 1 billion pounds are produced every year throughout the world. You know, if we have oily substances in perfumes, or if we had wood finishing, or we have lubricants, you know, that new car smell that becomes pungent after the car has been sitting in the sun for a few hours, that's the odor of phthalates. It volatilizes right out of the hot plastic dashboard. So it's not uncommon for individuals that have a brand new car to end up getting an oily coating on the inside of their windshields simply from the phthalates coming out of the plastic on the dashboard. Well, you know, there's an old approach to toxicology, and that old approach talks about high-level exposure. And high-level exposure means you get one big old blast of whatever the compound is they're studying. But, you know, as we go further with this concept of hormesis, this concept that low-dose toxicity, especially during critical windows of fetal development or in the growth of the child, can really have tragic health consequences. And so, since these multifunctional chemicals of phthalates are used in such a variety of consumer and personal care products, it's almost impossible for you to not be exposed to them. You know, somebody asked me in my practice this week, could they be tested for toxins? And I said, well, do you have $20,000? And they said, what, are you kidding? And I said, well, you know, the nature of testing for all of these different toxins in the body is an incredibly expensive process. And the thing that we do want to do is we want to do everything that we can to reduce our TTL, our total toxic load. So high doses of phthalates don't really constitute risks in a sense of traditional toxicology, but these low doses that are going in on virtually a daily basis for some people. You know, you're going to turn over your bottle of shampoo or your conditioner or your mousse or, you know, hair stiffener or hairspray and find phthalates on that label. You're exposing yourself to them on a daily basis. And, you know, the part that's the spookiest to me is when you're doing it when you're pregnant or you're doing it to your infant. You know, the National Toxicology Program has really worked tremendously hard to convene the panel of independent experts over the last 10 years to review the scientific evidence that address these developmental threats that happen from phthalates. And it turns out that they have very serious concern, especially when it comes to little boy babies and the development, their testicular development. It turns out phthalates are anti-androgenic. In other words, they suppress the masculinizing compounds that are in the body. So we have a feminizing effect on boys. We have a feminizing effect on their brain. Literally, we change the alignment of the brain to the girly view. And, you know, so many people think that all of this is cultured. You know, we give little boys trucks and we give little girls dolls and, you know, but if you don't make a choice for the kids, the little boys still choose the trucks and the little girls still choose the dolls. So when we look at these low-level effects of phthalates and the constant human exposure that happens, we know that we can change not only sperm production and testicular size, but we can actually change the brain. So the pattern of genital changes that were seen in baby boys are now being called phthalate syndrome. Now, you got to figure out that there's got to happen to an awful lot of people before they can give it a syndrome name. When we look at the debate about regulation and public health protection, we continue to see the protection of the industry. You know, if you read in yesterday's New York Times the amount of environmental protection that the Republicans were trying to tack on to some of these debt bills that are going on. They're literally trying to undo the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Chemicals Act, the ability to protect endangered species. All of those things were tacked on as amendments to some of the bills that are in Congress right now. And they were trying to be slid in the side door when all of this attention is on the debt reduction issue and the raising of the debt ceiling so that they hope that nobody would notice. But, you know, pull up the New York Times from yesterday and look at the undoing of what it's taken us 40 years to get in place to protect the American public from the dangers of chemicals. And you can tip your hat to the Republicans that have put all those bills in, and that's a specific target because there weren't any Democrats that put any of those amendments on to break down the regulations that we have already in place. European regulators really began to explore the ban on toys intended for infants a long time ago. And so the industry lobbying that helps set the pace here in the United States headed off the ban. Now, it not only proved unsuccessful ultimately in Europe, but there was a call by the Consumer Product Safety Commission in the United States for a phase-out by U.S. manufacturers, a voluntary phase-out. Yeah, start holding your breath now. So the nature of looking at hormesis, of little teeny tiny amounts of exposure that you're getting on a daily basis, makes a huge big difference in terms of your body. And so it's one of the ways that toxins are making us both fat and diabetic. You know, when there are 9,000 different chemicals that are being made at the rate of trillions of pounds, companies manufacture 6.5 trillion pounds. That's 3.25 billion tons, enough to fill an ocean supertanker. And so the Environmental Working Group's new study showed that the average person has 91 toxic chemicals in their body. Some people had as many as 165, including 96 known to cause cancer, 94 known to be toxic to the brain and nervous system, and 79 known to cause birth defects and abnormal fetal development. The Environmental Working Group study found an average of 200 industrial compounds, pollutants, and chemicals in the umbilical cord blood of 10 newborns. We've talked about that study before. These 10 babies were born in Los Angeles, and they took their cord blood on the day they were born, and they had over 200 carcinogenic and toxic chemicals that went everything from DDT to fire retardants to PCBs to polybromated dioxins, mercury. Now, if that isn't enough, the standard American diet itself is highly toxic. Processed and refined foods, industrial seed oils, high fructose corn syrup, even so-called healthy foods like whole grains and soy can even have a toxic effect on the body when you're eating them in a genetically modified form. So the evidence has been mounting over the last decade, linking exposure to these toxins to both obesity and diagnosis. Toxins cause inflammation. They cause immune dysregulation. They can help to create autoimmune inflammatory diseases. Environmental toxins interfere with the glucose metabolism. They interfere with cholesterol metabolism. They can disrupt the function of the energy factories inside your cell, the mitochondria. They can create oxidative stress and actually light up inflammation. They can alter thyroid metabolism and impair appetite regulation. There's probably other mechanisms that we don't yet understand. But that's certainly a big enough list to explain the link between toxins and diabetes. Yeah, the combination of diabetes and obesity. Why am I so concerned about it? Because I see people hurt. I see people significantly hurt by the fact that diabetes speeds the rate of heart disease by 400%. And when we realize that heart disease is the single biggest killer we have in America, more than half of the deaths in America are coming from heart disease, we have to look at these chemicals like phthalates, like BPA. We've talked about bisphenol A on this show before. Whether it's found in packaged foods or it's found in your plastic bottles. A recent study that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association found that bisphenol A increased the risk of diabetes, heart disease, and abnormal liver function. Environmental Health Perspectives was a beautiful study that was just released that found exposure to organic pollutants leads to insulin resistance. Now, when we look at insulin resistance or metabolic syndrome or pre-diabetes, what we're looking at is how does the cell actually utilize glucose? How does the glucose get into the cell in the first place? And then how does the mitochondria in the cell use glucose to create energy? When we look at a cell, we always have to look at the membrane or the wall of the cell. You know, this is a favorite subject of mine because I think membrane science is the most amazing science. I always use the hard-boiled egg as a way to give you a visual example of a cell membrane because when you peel off the shell of the hard-boiled egg, right underneath the shell is this little scrawny, thin layer of material. But you have to remember that material has been cooked, so it's a bit hardened. But that is the cell wall. The same as the cell wall in every one of the 70 trillion cells that are in your body. Only thing is it's not cooked. So if you can imagine peeling an egg that isn't hard boiled and keeping that membrane intact so you had a liquid egg sitting in your hand wrapped up in a bag of fat, then you got a visual of the membrane because the membrane is a fat bag. It's holding water inside and, you know, fat separates. And water don't mix, so if you make a bag out of fat, then you can hold the cell in integrity. And almost all the action that's taken place in your body, all of the metabolic processes, all the nutritive processes, all the elimination of waste that go on in the body are all going on the surface of that membrane. And it's one of the reasons I recommend fish oil is one of the most important supplements that you can take after your multivitamin, multimineral. You know, fish oil has lots of different quality. And boy, have I seen the good, the bad, and the ugly in my practice this week. Remember, you always want to get fish oil that comes to you from the Arctic, that comes from Norway, that comes from Scandinavia, that comes from somewhere in the European Union because their regulations are so much more stringent than they are here in the United States. They will not let that fish oil be shipped out of port until it's been tested for heavy metals like lead, cadmium, arsenic, mercury, aluminum. They also test it for PCBs, polyvinyl chlorides. They also test it for PCBs. They also test it for dioxin. So all of those contaminants are checked in the oils, and the oils are processed through a process called molecular distillation. So if you look at your bottle of fish oil, and it doesn't indicate that it comes from Scandinavia or the European Union somewhere, and it doesn't say molecularly distilled anywhere on the body, well, then I wouldn't put it in my mouth, frankly. But that fish oil helps to make the membrane of the cell. Actually, the membrane of the cell is made by the fats that you eat, whatever they are. If you eat lousy fats all day long, you know, you're eating baked goods for breakfast and you're going to Burger Doodle for lunch and you're having French fries and, you know, all kinds of fried foods and just getting poor quality fats in the diet, if you're eating a lot of saturated fats because you're eating a lot of pork and beef, then that cell membrane is going to be more resistant to doing all the jobs that it has to do. If you're a fishitarian and you're getting 2 to 4 servings of fish in every week, well, more power to you, especially if it's Alaskan or Pacific salmon, the small tunas, the light tuna. Remember, we don't want to eat white or albacore tuna. It has as much as 6 times the amount of mercury that we find in light tuna. they're different species. Light tuna is a small fish, like a skipjack. The great big tunas, the yellowfins, the bluefins, you know, these are the fishes that often show up in the albacore or the white tuna with much higher concentrations of toxins. But if you're getting fatty fish in salmon and herring, the sardines, these are fishes that are going to give you those good fatty acids so that that membrane in the cell is working well. Well, it appears that these toxins like phthalates can gum up the works. They can make us insulin resistant and create metabolic syndrome. Insulin resistance means exactly that. The cell doesn't want to use insulin well to push the glucose into the cell. Insulin's like a key. And so you got to turn the key in the lock in order to let the glucose into the cell. And if you've ever had a key made and they didn't sand it off in a finished way, and there was a little burr that was left on one of those key tags, and you tried to turn it in the lock and it fit in the lock, but it just wouldn't turn. That's exactly what can happen when we become insulin resistant. We can't get the glucose into the cell, and so the pancreas has to pump out way more insulin to try to shove the glucose into the cell. Ultimately, we can exhaust the beta cells in the pancreas, and then we become an insulin-dependent diabetic. But we've seen that these persistent organic pollutants that exist in the environment, in your food, and in your water are things that are changing the body in such a way as we're becoming insulin resistant, we're creating obesity, and creating diabetes. So when we look at all these international studies that have examined the relationship between environmental influences and diabetes, we have to do a literature review. And so, happily, that literature search was done. So we take the National Library of Medicine, the PubMed, which is the Medline search mechanism. There's also an academic health reference center that exists. And we can use all of those search engines to find all of the scientific literature that's been done in the last 30 years, looking at a relationship between environmental toxins and an increased risk of diabetes, and we find two very distinct relationships over and above phthalates. We find arsenic and dioxin. And right away you say, well, I get along well with my spouse, and so I'm not expecting I'm going to find arsenic in my coffee. Well, get real. Arsenic is a naturally occurring element. It's all through the Earth's crust, but it doesn't sit in one form. It's not like you find a vein of gold or a vein of arsenic. It's all distributed all through the Earth's crust. But fundamentally, arsenic is transported by water in the United States. And arsenic can combine with other elements. It can combine with chlorine or sulfur or oxygen, and it's referred to as inorganic arsenic. And then arsenic from the soil can show up in plants and the animals that eat that plant and form organic arsenic. So organic arsenic is less toxic than the inorganic form. But the main exposure in the general population is through ingesting high arsenic drinking water. Our major concern today is exposure through untested well water. Probably 500,000 people in the United States may be drinking well water that has unacceptable levels of arsenic in it. But there are other routes. There are drugs that contain inorganic arsenic that have been used in the treatment of leukemia, psoriasis, asthma. Sometimes wine has arsenic in it. Sometimes mineral waters even contain arsenic. And so you've heard many times here on No Nonsense Nutrition me talking about the fact that you need to get an absolute 1 micron filter hooked to your faucet. Stop buying the plastic bottles. The planet can't tolerate more plastic bottles. A tenth of Sarasota County's landfill is plastic bottles. We're leaching some of these plastics into our body just by being drinking out of the bottles and reusing the bottles. So when you put an absolute 1 micron filter on your faucet at home, you'll have an initial expense of buying a filter and getting it installed somewhere up in the $500 range. But once it's in there, you're only going to have to spend $80 once a year to get yourself a replacement filter cartridge. It'll cost you $1.50 a week. So when we look at arsenic exposure, I do testing for arsenic in my practice. I don't happen to be a fan of hair analysis testing. And the reason that I'm not is hair analysis really only tells you what's been going on in the past 30 days. It doesn't give you any idea what the body burden is. But when we do a body burden test, when we use chelating agents like the chemical EDTA or DMSA or DMPS, these are chemicals that when we put them in the body, they have an affinity for these heavy metals. And remember, all metals are minerals, but not all minerals are metals. So we're looking for arsenic, cadmium, lead, mercury, and aluminum, most notably. And so you give somebody a handful of pills when they get up in the morning, and then they collect their urine over the next 6 or 24 hours, depending on what we're testing for. And a sample of that urine is sent off to a laboratory, and we find out what the body burden is of those metals. And so finding relationships between lead and hypertension has been very significant in my practice. But finding relationships between arsenic and diabetes is another rock to look under. So the association between arsenic and diabetes was demonstrated in 30 years of research literature. The higher the chronic arsenic exposure via the drinking water, the higher the diabetes in that particular area. There was also a relationship found to dioxin. Dioxin is a general term that's used to describe a family of compounds that are known as chlorinated dibenzo-p-dioxins. The major source of dioxin for you and I is our diet, because dioxin is fat soluble. It bioaccumulates up the food chain and is mainly found in meat and dairy products. Greatest concentration is in beef. Second greatest concentration is in milk, then chicken, then pork, fish, and eggs. So if you're a big beef eater, you're eating, you know, a burger one night and a steak another night and a roast beef sandwich another night, and then you're probably getting a lot of dioxin. It's highly persistent in the environment. The most toxic form is not intentionally manufactured in any industry. It's formed during the chlorine bleaching process that takes place at paper mills. When we bleach the paper to make our beautiful white paper towels and toilet paper and, you know, the paper that we print on in our computers and printers every day, we are contributing to the amount of dioxin that's out there. It's also formed during chlorination by the drinking water treatment plants. So because it's ubiquitous in food and it's persistent in the environment, it's enough reason to justify a public health concern. We know that it's related to cancers. We know that it's related to immunotoxicity and developmental and reproductive toxicity, that it's hard on the liver, it's hard on the brain. When we look at acne-like lesions, especially on the face and the upper body, we can remember from a number of years ago the dioxin poisoning that took place of a notable Russian diplomat. So measuring changes in blood and urine can indicate the liver damage that comes from exposure to dioxin. I can't even imagine how much dioxin must contaminate the individuals that live up around the Jacksonville area where all the pulp and paper plants exist. So we found again a relationship to diabetes prevalence. German workers that were exposed to dioxin found that the people that were exposed to the dioxin had diabetes at twice the rate of the people that worked at the plant that were not exposed to dioxin. So whether it's diabetes or whether it's just glucose metabolism in general and insulin production, study after study after study shows the suggestion that there is a relationship between arsenic exposure and diabetes and between dioxin exposure and diabetes. So between phthalates and arsenic and dioxin, you're saying, oh yeah, that makes a really good cocktail to have today. Well, but you know, you are being exposed. No, you're not going to the store and buying a jar of phthalates. You're not drinking a bottle of dioxin. You're not rubbing arsenic in your skin. But the fundamental thing that I'm trying to bring forward here is that toxins are changing the way your body works. So now let's look at cosmetics and perfumes and the fact that phthalates are used in these products on a regular basis. And as endocrine disruptors, we don't think when we shampoo our hair and put cream rinse on that we're exposing ourselves to something that potentially could affect the future development of diabetes and heart disease. And yet that is the case. When I look at the opportunity that I have to remove as many food toxins as I possibly can, that's the place that I want to start. See if you can reduce the amount that you get exposed to. So you got to ditch the processed and refined foods. You got to ditch the high fructose corn syrup. You've got to ditch the industrial seed oils. When you buy organic, you know, many times here on No Nonsense Nutrition, I've endorsed you going up on the EWG.org site and printing down their Dirty Dozen Clean 15 list. The Dirty Dozen are the 12 fruits and vegetables that have the highest contamination of pesticides. According to the United States Department of Agriculture testing of 100,000 specimens. That list changes every year. As usual, strawberries, peaches, and nectarines fight for number one of the most toxic fruits that are out there, and spinach and celery often fight for the second position, and bell peppers, the second position of the most toxic fruits and vegetables that we can eat. But the Clean 15 also tells you that if you'd never bought those 15 foods organically, it doesn't really matter. So buying organic food is one of the ways that you can reduce your food toxins. But it's the processed and refined food. You know, it's the meals that we eat out. It's the fact that we're still using canola oil. I never, ever, ever endorse the use of canola oil. Canola oil is a perfect example of an industrial seed oil. We don't sit down and eat a plate of canola, which is called rapeseed. So yes, it may be a food quality product, but in my opinion, canola oil is not appropriate for human consumption. The length of the molecule is longer than the cell wall is wide, so you can't really incorporate canola into the cell wall effectively. So every time you remove a food toxin by eating fresh, local, and organic food, you reduce your total toxic load. Then you have to look at reducing your exposure to chemicals at home. So whether it's household cleaning products or bath or beauty or hygiene products, reducing your exposure to chemicals at home is an important piece of it. And that's going to be from your, you know, dishwashing solution, you know, right through to your the spray that you use to clean your mirrors. When we see that epidemiological report after report links diabetes to phthalates, arsenic exposure, and to dioxins, anything that we can do to reduce our exposure not only protects us against diabetes, but it protects the pancreas itself. You know, when I look at the relationship of chemicals that are in the food to human personalities, human body types, we don't know who the person is that's going to be sensitive. We don't know who the individual is that's just going to get a little bit of MSG, and that MSG is going to open up calcium channels and constrict blood vessels and cause somebody to have sky-high blood pressure after they eat the typical Asian food meal. Somebody else can take in MSG, monosodium glutamate, and not have a big insulin response. But essentially, MSG causes a very large insulin response because there are, remember, it's monosodium glutamate. There are glutamate receptors in the pancreas. Well, we don't know what child is going to take in a little bit of MSG and as a result just turn hyper on you. You know, everybody thinks, oh, you give sugar to kids and sugar makes kids hyper. I've never actually seen that happen. What generally happens is the sugar is mixed with yellow dye number 5 or some other noxious agent, and that's actually what's causing the excitotoxins in the child. But recently I've seen a child that the combination of MSG plus a drink with NutraSweet in it at the same time turned the child wild, because the blood level of excitotoxins will double, triple, quadruple as a result of having insults with these non-natural molecules. You know, even things that we consider to be not good food, like soda pop, you know, we always think of the high fructose corn syrup as being the problem, and yet virtually all the soft drinks and even the related beverages contain benzene, which is a well-known carcinogen. You know, the EPA says the only safe amount of benzene is 0, and yet we have 5 to 140 parts per billion in every soft drink that was ever tested. A fair amount of benzene is taken in by our bodies by air pollution and just drinking water. So if you look on a can of soda pop and you see that potassium benzoate and sodium benzoate are in the soda pop to be used as preservatives, they preserve the freshness of the soft drinks. Well, they mix together with ascorbic acid, vitamin C, and they form benzenes. So potassium benzoate, sodium benzoate, and ascorbic acid sometimes are all in the same product, and so they make benzenes. We've seen diabetes related to benzenes, especially in kids. You know, when I started in practice, we had never seen diabetes type 2 in anybody under 30 years old, and then it was in nobody under 20 years old, and now we finally found a case of diabetes type 2 in somebody under 10 years old. Well, maybe the combination of arsenic and benzene and phthalates and together with dioxins is all it took. And let's throw a little bisphenol A in there. And so what's a girl to do? How do we live in a toxic world and live in a healthy way? Well, one of the things that we can do is, besides reducing the toxins in our food and reducing the exposure to chemicals in our home, is to support the body's natural detoxification capacity so that you can effectively deal with at least a good part of the toxins you're exposed to. You know, virtually everybody today has heard of milk thistle. The seeds of milk thistle, Silymarin is the compound that you'll see on the label. Syllabum is actually the name of the plant. But things like milk thistle are one of the things that help the liver detoxify. Artichoke leaf extract. And so that tells you eating artichokes is good for detoxification. You know, dandelion, when I lived in Flagstaff, Arizona, and I had so many dandelions in my yard, and no chemicals had ever been sprayed out there, so it was easy for me to go out and pick dandelion leaves to put in salad or to cook like spinach, dandelion flowers, which I used to push down into the pancakes and cook them in the pancakes. And no, I never did make dandelion wine, but dandelion roots dried and made into tea that's a bile stimulant. And so every time we take dandelion or dandelion root, what we're doing is stimulating the liver to go ahead and secrete its bile and help to take the trash out. Ingredients like the spice turmeric. Turmeric has got an active ingredient called curcumin. And I take a capsule of curcumin every morning and another capsule of it every night. You know, we've always talked about the fact that the people of India have the lowest rate of Alzheimer's disease in the world, and they eat curcumin or turmeric in their curries on virtually a daily basis all of their lives. When we get vitamin C and vitamin E and zinc and selenium and lipoic acid that we talked about a couple of weeks ago, all of those antioxidants are things that help support healthy liver detoxification. We clearly see that homeopathic remedies, homeopathic detoxifiers taken on a daily basis, can help the body take out the trash. Eating members of the cabbage family and the onion family, cabbage, broccoli, cauliflower, bok choy, arugula, Brussels sprouts, kale, radishes, all of these things help to take out the trash. Onions, garlic, leeks, shallots, spring onions, scallions, all of these things help the body take out the trash. Asparagus, artichokes, other ones that support healthy liver detoxification. I had a client last week that asked me about doing what she referred to as a liver flush. And over again, these recipes have been given in holistic environments of people doing this special kind of program where they're glugging down a half a cup of cod liver oil and they're olive oil, and they're taking it in with cayenne pepper and maple syrup, and there are various different combinations that have been used for years, and then people feel like they get rid of gallstones, and so they'll look in the toilet and they'll see these lumps and they'll say, oh, well, they passed gallstones. Well, you wish. In fact, more often than not, that's nothing but congealed olive oil that's coming out of there. But the point being that the intention was good. And so what we want to do is we want to include in our diet the foods like beets, as an example, that really help to do a very good job of keeping that bile moving and as a result get those toxins out of the liver. You know, beets are a love-hate relationship for a lot of people. You know, I happen to be on the love side. So just take a beet and coat it with a little olive oil and put it in a bread pan and stick it in a 350-degree oven. And if it's the size of a ping pong ball, leave it in there for a half an hour. And if it's the size of a tennis ball, leave it in there for an hour. And you got roasted beets, and you don't have to go any further than that. You know, you can steam them, you can grate them raw and put them in your salad. You can put them in the juicer and throw them in your juice, but all of the things that help to increase the flow of bile, even something simple like peppermint tea. When you chew on those mints after a meal, I'm talking about real mints. If you chew on those mints after a meal, you increase bile flow, which helps to support liver detoxification. So try to get in asparagus every week. Try to eat an artichoke now and then. You know, think about using dandelion teas or having some more beets or borscht or pickle beets even. Think about using a supplement like curcumin, selenium, zinc, vitamin C, vitamin E, lipoic acid. All of these things that can enhance your body's natural detoxification. You know, a study by the British Medical Journal says 75% of most cancers are caused by environmental factors. Columbia University School of Public Health claims that 95% of cancer is caused by diet and environmental toxicity. There's 77,000 chemicals that are produced here in North America, and over 3,000 of them are added to our food supply. Over 10,000 of them are used in food processing as solvents, emulsifiers, preservatives, all kinds of processing initiatives. There's over 1,000 new chemicals that are introduced in America every year, and they aren't tested. So we know there are other prevalent chemicals in the environment, from polychlorinated biphenols to pesticides, from molds and other fungal toxins to the volatile organic compounds that come from paints, asbestos, heavy metal, chlorine. All of these things are the most common toxins that we're exposed to. But our attention today is on phthalates. And so what I want you to do is look at the bath, beauty, and hygiene products that you have at home and see how often you see phthalates. Sometimes they've got the word PEG, P-E-G, in front of the chemical name as a way to, well, I would say disguise the fact that they're phthalates. And if you find out that the shampoo and the cream rinse and the hairspray and the mousse and things like that that you're using, in fact, contain those phthalates, then I'm going to strongly recommend that you replace that product. When I ask people to be this vigilant, it's because I see people that are hurt. I see people that are in pain. I see individuals that can't live their life the way they want to because they've been affected by these toxins. The costs of care are enormous. And so when people say to me, well, I can't afford the shampoo that doesn't have the phthalates in it, or I can't afford, you know, to buy house cleaning products that are non-toxic. You know, I'm reminded of what my mother did with baking soda, salt, and a steel wool pad. A little vinegar and water for cleaning her windows with newspapers. I don't remember that my mother ever had a toxic chemical in the house. Everything she did was, you know, she'd go to clean the oven before we had self-cleaning ovens, and it was salt and a steel wool pad. When she went to clean the bathtub, it was baking soda and a sponge. When she went to clean the windows, it was vinegar and water and wiping it with newspapers. So it may not be as hip, but I think health is pretty hip. So name your poison. You know, a guide to the most common toxins that exist is right in your body. And you may, by the time you leave the house in the morning with shampooing and soap and toothpaste and moisturizers and deodorant and perfume and body lotion and hairspray and conditioner, and you might be exposing yourself to a couple of hundred toxins before you ever walk out the door. So when we look at what's toxic and what's not, let's see if we can't control what we can control. And one of the things that we can control is our exposure to these plasticizers. So whether it's a credit card or a soda bottle, plastics have given us a lot of lightweight, durable, and inexpensive consumer goods. But they've also create dioxin when they're burned. They're never biodegradable, and they use large amounts of natural resources.